is Hyperspace Theology, exploring what we can know about life and faith and God Almighty through a galaxy far, far away.
Welcome to Hyperspace Theology, a show in which we're exploring theology through the lens of a galaxy far, far away. From belief to redemption, orthodoxy to resurrection, the Star Wars galaxy is jam-packed with theological themes, and we are going to crack them wide open. Hopefully, this can be of help to you in your journey of faith, or at the very least, can enhance your appreciation for the galaxy we all know and love. I'm your host, Jared Mays, coming to you from Leominster, Massachusetts. Joining me once again this week is, from Corpus Christi, Texas, Dr. Kevin Burr.
Guys, it's good to be back in the saddle with y'all. Happy to be back, ready to go.
Excellent. Glad to have you. Unfortunately, tonight, we don't have Scott Howland, but it's not all that unfortunate because we do have a fill-in, somebody I'm very excited to be talking about. We love you, Scott. That wasn't a diss. You never know what's going to come out of my mouth, especially when we start podcasting. Filling in the place of Scott Howland this week is my favorite coffee-slinging, Star Wars-loving, Bible-believing friend from Edmond, Oklahoma, Kerry Verner.
Hey, guys. Very good to be with you. First-time caller, but, like, fifth-time listener.
See, we've done 8 shows now, so, like, yeah, that's...
That's above average. Give him
some above average.
Yeah.
Is that what you say to your students, Dr. Burr? Is above average of an effort there?
I'm a little gentler, but yeah, since Carrie is not my student.
Fun fact, though, Carrie was actually the person introduced Kevin and myself back in 2013. Is that right?
I would think so.
Maybe. It would definitely be because we were traveling together.
Yeah.
I don't know if I personally introduced you.
You were like, hey, Jared, this is Kevin. He sits at this table every day. You should meet him. He's the SA president.
I was the student body president of seminary. Yeah. That's not nearly as impressive. Like when the student body is like 150 yeah. people, as opposed to at the time, Harding, our alma mater, was the largest private school in Arkansas, private university in Arkansas. So like 5,000 students. But, you know.
Well, I thought it was impressive, and you made a good
first
impression.
I was going for quality, not quantity.
You know, when I met you, I was like, can't wait for 10 years from now to have a podcast with this guy. Actually,
a podcast with this guy.
Was not on my radar, but, you know, it was on my radar, both Star Wars and Christianity. Gary, introduce the listeners a little bit to, you know, who you are, what you're about, what you do. Tell us everything we need to know in, like, 2 minutes.
Okay. So I first met Jared at a lake house, and we were both married. So I'm going to start off right there, of course, where our relationship begins. And that was an integral point in my life, in my wife's life, as we were gearing up to do mission work and decided, man, we're going to be like Bible majors, and we're going to go on and do some amazing things. And so from there, I graduated from the same university that I believe both of you did, and then went on to a seminary the following year, which is, Jared, that's really the year you and I became close,
yeah,
because of our traveling back and forth together. But after that year, my wife and I were expecting our first child, my son Jude. He is now 7, and I stopped taking classes as quickly. Eventually, I just completely ran out of gas and was done. But I took a job working for a church in East Texas, in Texarkana, right where Texas meets Arkansas.
Which is funny because Rick, who was our last guest, lives like right around the corner from Texarkana.
Where is he?
Oh, wow.
I couldn't tell you.
Okay. All right.
You have to go back and listen to Hyperspace Theology, Episode 8, and find out.
I know he's, I've heard about where he's from, and I'm familiar with that piney wood area.
Sounds like it has a bad reputation. Oh, I've heard about that place.
I've heard about that. No, we had a really great time there. I had a good experience working with the church. And then a lady at that church got me into coffee roasting. And I also got into hobby of entrepreneurship and small business ownership / management. And this opportunity came open at Oklahoma Christian University here in Edmond, Oklahoma, to run a coffee shop as a college ministry, and I was fortunate enough to get the job, and I have loved it. I haven't looked back, but I very much argue the fact that I am still in full-time ministry. It's just not working with the church.
Yeah, that's right. You're trying to burn the beans instead of burn the souls of non-believers. No, cut that one out.
I don't think that one landed very well.
You got to shoot your shot sometimes. You know,
you do.
Of course, Carrie and I have had the chance to keep working together every summer, just about every summer, at the Caruso Experience at Harding University, where we work at a preacher training camp. And this summer, I was like, Carrie, we got to sit down and record an episode of Hyperspace Theology. I brought my little Zoom recorder and everything, but we were staying in a cinder block dorm room, which, like, notoriously not great for podcast quality. So here we are. You made it. We finally made the time. We had to kick Scott out in order to get you here. No, we would have done it with Scott. His work schedule didn't quite line up this week. But tell us a little bit about why you love Star Wars.
Well, okay, my mom introduced me to Star Wars, I want to say when I was about 7. And I very vividly remember seeing the Death Star run as they're going through the trench and just like, I've never been so tense in my life at this point. I had been in like Scooby-Doo, but Scooby-Doo is not that intense. It's mostly just zoinks.
It's a little predictable.
Jinkies. Yeah, and like you can tell which door is about to open and they'll fall through. And this, I had no idea what was going to happen. And it was just so exciting. But it was also that relationship building with my mom. And that continues to this day. In fact, my son Jude has just gotten into Star Wars. And it's been very rewarding to watch him just love it and want to watch it on its own. He's reading books that are Star Wars now. Tiny, tiny little grade 2.
Did you give him Darth Plagueis? It's only like 430 pages.
I'm sure he'll be there soon. But so he's actually with my mom right now. He's out of school for the week. And so he's not with my mom anymore, but he was. And I'm sure they watched some Star Wars together. So it's neat to see that come full circle.
Nice.
You should generations of Star Wars lovers.
Record like a video of his review of Star Wars. We'll post it on our Hyperspace Theology Instagram page.
Okay.
And get his review. About the lightsabers and, you know, Darth Vader.
What do you think, Jude? It was cool.
Yeah. That's a much better impression of your own son than mine.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. Well, it's actually a really good segue for what tonight's topic is going to be, because we're talking about how do we train those who are following in our footsteps? What is the process with which we equip disciples in Christianity, or of course from the Star Wars perspective, how the Jedi and the Sith, you know, train new adherents to their particular codes? And so this actually was a topic suggested by one of our listeners, Reed Stafford. Do you know Reed, Carrie? I know that Kevin and I both do.
Oh, I know Reed.
Okay, great. That sounded cryptic.
I bumped.
Sounds like Reed has a bad reputation.
No, Reed started a youth ministry job in Houston
a
few years ago where a lot of OC kids were, and he would come up and support them doing things, which was, man, what a great youth ministry. He would drive like 8 hours to come see his kids in a play. But in so doing, he would sit in the coffee shop called The Brew, where I work.
Yeah, and plug your coffee shop, Carrie. So, just shameless plug. Hey. No ads here or anything.
Bam, baby. So we started talking, and, we just kind of hit it off and hung out after that. We had mutual friends.
Perfect.
But we definitely know each other.
So what the lesson to learn here, listeners, is if you submit a topic to us, you could also get us to discuss how exactly we know you and every little bit of personal detail we can possibly manage to muster. Anyway, this particular topic was suggested by one of our listeners, Reed. He offered up the idea that we would examine the differences between how the Jedi and the Sith trained their up-and-coming adherents and cross-examine that with common discipleship models. And honestly, that's a better idea than almost any of the other ideas that I've got written down for this show. And there's like 100 that we've got running in a Google Doc. And so really excited that Reed threw that one out there. I want to say to all of our listeners, hey, if you've got a topic, an idea, no guarantee that it'll make it on the show. But we'd love to hear from you anyway, just like Reed did. So let's talk about, first and foremost, what this looks like to, from the Star Wars perspective, what it looks like to train a new up-and-coming, interested potential candidate. Let's start on the light side. What's the Jedi's, go-to method for training a up-and-coming Jedi?
I mean, obviously, in the height of the Jedi's power, or at least maybe not the height of their power, but at the time when the temple was still functioning as it should have been, I mean, they basically took them in, right, from across the galaxy. And then in some way or another, discerned which master to set them up with as Padawans. And if I'm understanding correctly, it was generally kind of a one-to-one correspondence, right? You know, like you have one Padawan and one master. That comes to a head with, you know, Qui-Gon, who is willing to train little Anakin, but already has a Padawan, as the council tells him. So
I am ready for the trials, Master.
It's not bad.
Already in episode one, Anakin is getting dissed by the council. It continues through the prequel trilogy.
It's brutal.
All the way through, yeah. But that's generally how I understand it. I'm generalizing. But
I know that most of our listeners are big Star Wars fans. Some are less Christian than others or not Christian at all. And hey, we're grateful that you are a listener regardless. But let's say there is that random fan that's, you know, not as hip with all the Star Wars lingo. The basic idea here is that you would spend, 10, 12 years apprenticing under a Jedi Master one-on-one, hanging out with them as if you are their own son or daughter. Going everywhere, living on a spaceship with them or the Jedi Temple. You obviously have no relationship with your parents. And so it's more than just an apprenticeship where you clock in and clock out. It's a round the clock, fully immersive experience, for better or for worse. Sometimes it'll leave you, you know, stranded in a volcano with all of your limbs burning to pieces because the relationship falls apart. Other times it ends in a promotion and then you can become best buddies and going on missions together and that sort of thing. Obviously, that's a retcon from the original trilogy. There was no mention of Padawans, no Padawan braids. You guys remember, what was your initial thought on Padawan braids first time you saw them? I thought, yeah, Star Wars is ruined forever.
Not me. I said, hey, Mom, I want to be Obi-Wan for Halloween.
No, did you wear one?
Oh, you better believe I wore a Padawan braid.
Nice.
Round the shoulder. I believe it was around the right shoulder and draped over. And, man, that thing was so cheap. Pulled my hair. I very vividly remember it just, like, constantly pulling my hairs out.
I remember.
Probably had a little bald spot.
Driving up in my grandparents' house. It would have been, summer of 99, 2000, shortly after the movie had come out. And my cousin Spencer was waiting for us, like, so excited to play Star Wars with me. And he was holding a lightsaber and wearing a Padawan braid. And I just remember giving him, at age, like, 8, giving him this straight face, like, what on earth do you think you're doing? Why are you wearing that? Regardless, the point, of course, is that it's a really intense experience, but also a very personal one. Obviously, we see in the original trilogy Luke being trained by, first and foremost, old Ben Kenobi. That's not very, long-lasting. Poor Ben. Didn't really make out for much of a relationship there, but he didn't leave Luke stranded. Obviously, commissioned Luke to go to Dagobah and train under a frog-like Jedi Master named Yoda. Let's talk about Yoda's teaching methods here for a minute. Evaluate Yoda as a Jedi Master, at least in The Empire Strikes Back. 1 to 10 scale, Carrie. Evaluate, rate Yoda's performance, like ratemyprofessor.com. Are you on there, Kevin?
I hope not. I don't think so.
I bet he's got chili peppers on there. You know what that means. Somebody thinks you're hot, Kevin.
That's terrible.
Spicy.
That's terrifying. I didn't know
that. Yeah, Max Sandlin always brags about the fact he got one.
That's great.
If I were Luke, I think I would be just devastated by the tutelage of Yoda constantly. There's no encouragement. I can't think of a single time when Yoda's like, good job. You know, it's always here's a wise proverb that shows how foolish you are.
That is why you fail. I'm not afraid. You will be. Still the scariest line in all of Star Wars.
You will be.
Right. And that is a teaching method. right? To scare somebody straight, to be constantly critiquing them. You can never quite measure up. That is a teaching method, whether or not you think it's a good one. It motivated Luke.
We could dig into the nature of the discipler if we're going to use this kind of, you know, church terminology or terminology that's common to churches. We tend to talk about the apprenticeship outside of church context.
Yeah.
The notion is discipleship. Disciple is a word that is often found in the Bible to refer to Jesus' students, basically. And it's interesting to kind of look at Yoda as discipler when you also know some of his backstory, especially Clone Wars material, prequel trilogy stuff. Yoda's not old enough for High Republic. Is that right? Like that was before him?
No, he's there. He's there? It's okay. A bold move. Right, so. Should he be there? Okay. That's another question.
I don't know very much about all that because I just hadn't gotten into it yet. We're working through Visions right now. Watched The Elder last night. Man, loved it. Anyway,
hey, there's a good Star Wars connotation.
Master
here.
And Padawan, which I'll get to later. But yeah, Yoda seems disillusioned, and the prequel trilogy gives us some very clear indications of kind of why he is that way. Carrie, yeah, you're right. Like, it is, man, a lot of it is a bummer. And I remember really loving Yoda after seeing him. But then, you know, it's kind of like that red pill moment just now. It's like, oh, yeah, there wasn't really a lot of positivity there. I wonder if he's just this grizzled old veteran. It's really easy. Maybe he's maybe burnout is what you could say.
Yeah, have we
disillusionment?
Done an episode on burnout yet? I don't think we have.
We haven't.
You know, but if you look at the full scope of Yoda, who is in all the trilogies, he seems to be slightly behind what's going on with the dark side. Whereas you have, this isn't a prequel trilogies, you kind of got a Mace Windu who's like, you know what, we need to assassinate Dooku in some books like Dark Disciple, or he can't stand trial. He's talking about Darth Sidious. Yeah. And he's kind of got his saber towards him. And he's like, no, he needs to die right here. He sort of has this like just vindictive justice that needs to happen right then and there. And he's kind of the person that you point at and say that the Jedi lost their way in a lot of ways in the Republic. And so you see Yoda kind of being like, I don't know, maybe something's going on with us as Jedi. We shouldn't be so confident in our ways that we couldn't possibly be wrong. And I think of that whenever Obi-Wan is saying there's all these moons going around this one spot that's been erased, and Jocasta News like, no, the records can't be wrong. But Yoda's has the little younglings and say, well, what makes sense, younglings? And they say, well, there must be something there. And he says, ah, this must be true. And so he kind of goes from this, he's on to something, but he's just a step behind Sidious and everything's clouded. And then you kind of see him go towards, there's not a whole lot of hope, and he does seem pretty jaded in the original trilogy, although very lovable at the same time and willing to train. But then you see him in the most recent trilogy, where he's kind of a step ahead of Luke. Luke is this sulking old master who's like, man, what's going on? And he's like, let the tree burn.
Right. He's got a different kind of burnout than Yoda might have had in Empire.
And it's like Yoda's kind of worked his way through it. And so kind of watching that transition over time is pretty neat.
It's a good lesson for us to see that even teachers have something to learn. And there's a really key quote there from Yoda in The Last Jedi. I don't know if we've made it through a single episode of Hyperspace Theology without talking about The Last Jedi, even though none of the three of us really like it all that much.
What a tragedy, right?
I'm going to have an unpopular opinion. I watched it with Jude recently, and I thought, I like it.
I'm glad. I have not rewatched it in a couple years.
There are some phrases and like little proverbs and things that are just so poetic within it.
There are. And one of them being from Yoda, which is, we are what they grow beyond. So the teacher wants to be eclipsed by the student. We want to let them leave us behind on Dagobah or Octo, right? We want to grow out of our usefulness and to see them excel and exceed us. And that's a really good lesson to learn. I'm glad that Yoda eventually learned it and Luke is trying to learn it. Did he learn it? It's hard to know exactly. Kind of, a little bit. However, the Sith have a really different model when it comes to training up their adherents, and it is we never want them to go beyond us, because if they get too powerful, well, then they will eclipse us and take our power, and they'll become the Dark Lord of the Sith. Of course, they do have a really interesting training style, though, don't they? Let's talk about the Rule of Two. This is, of course, a notorious method of we're going to have two and only two Sith dark side force users who are trying to conquer the galaxy. We're going to have, you know, the Emperor and Vader, for example. Or
well, only there's always more than two.
Right, right. There's a lot.
there's always three, maybe even four, vying for the position of two.
Waiting in the wings. Right. Well, say what you will about, you know, evil villains. They're not always the best at following the rules. So there's that.
Yeah, it's true.
Kevin, I want to pitch it to you. What is there to admire about the Sith's method of always having one master and one apprentice? You're laughing at this. It's not an entirely bad method.
Tell me the positives about these genocidal child murderers.
And I'm going to let Carrie take the good. Right, you good cop, bad cop.
Yeah. They did, at least, to their credit, I guess, in a weird and terrible way, they did at least recognize that if they were going to achieve their goals, they needed to drastically change how they brought up individuals within their, let's call it a religion, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
That is not an inappropriate way to describe this notion. I mean, I forget which officer it is in A New Hope.
Yeah,
but one of them basically talks, you know, tells Vader that he's the last of his religion. Okay, so they eventually, for the continuation of their religion, they realized we are modeling this in a way that is ultimately self-destructive. So we need to put some kind of caps on this. Now, in typical Sith fashion, it's brutal. It is murderous. It's vindictive. And, you know, it ultimately comes to, you could say it ultimately comes to bite them, but I don't know. I mean, Sidious won.
Well, the issue there, I would say, is that he never wanted Vader to really become as knowledgeable as him. He always wanted to keep Vader under his thumb. He never wanted to be the kind of teacher who saw his student excel. He always wanted to manipulate and control Anakin, who became Vader, and always had apprentices, whether it was Maul or Count Dooku, apprentices who specialized in one specific thing but were not well-rounded, nor could they see the whole picture. Right, Maul was a powerful assassin. Dooku was a good influencer, a leader of men. And Vader could kill Jedi. Right, he could intimidate. He was the enforcer in the suit. Carrie,
I think we've moved on to the bad things now.
Right. Carrie, why is this a lacking method?
Man, you know what? Here's the thing. My favorite Star Wars, like, deep dive, if I'm going to get into anything, is to explore the dark side. And so I first want to start by saying that even though I don't really want to practice it personally, I'm fascinated by the way that they can use fear and leverage and confusion. And ultimately, if you kind of look at the Rule of Two, the book with Darth Bane trilogy.
Yeah.
all the way even to the rise of Skywalker. I mean, there is this movement to, I want to raise up a powerful apprentice so that I can trick them and invade their very body.
Right.
You know, so I'm like kind of amazed at the storytelling. But the negative side, which is what you asked about, why does this not work? Well, the manipulation of people is never a good thing. You can always, you can manipulate people quite easily through fear, through threats, through, let's say you're a boss or a manager. And what I'm thinking about right now is, have you watched Parks and Rec?
Yeah.
Where, there's an argument between Chris Traeger and Ron Swanson about which is more effective. Chris Traeger's method, which is kill them with kindness and encouragement and inspire them to do the work. And Ron says, no, they need to fear you and you need to threaten them and make them do the work. And so what happens is they get old Gary, Larry, Terry Gergich to be the lackey who's trying to put away these red and blue files. And what they find is that they are both effective and not effective in their own right. And so that's kind of the metaphor that my mind goes to.
That's a really good analogy.
They are both effective, but there is one that I think as people, if we are the learners, that we want to be treated as. And also, I think that we should, as human beings that are, regardless of if you're a Christian or not, and you respect the humanity of the person across from you, then inspiring and going about treating them with a high view of humanity yeah. is always going to be greater from a humanitarian point of view than the less moral, less ethical, well, I'm just trying to get what I want, the Ubermensch or the Overman, which is, what is that, Nietzsche? Is that his, like...
Mm-hmm. Lost on me.
Yeah. Well, I've got Kevin here, so I just throw him a softball and...
Way more letters after his name.
Yeah.
It's ultimately, do you want people to be their best selves or their worst selves? And you can get results out of people when they are at their worst. However, obviously we're going to be saying that the Jedi's model is better. You want to equip and train and apprentice a particular individual and give them your best pour of yourself into them. Give them everything that you have to offer and then say, but you have something, a different set of skills. You don't have to be just like me. You can move on. I want you to go train an apprentice now, and I'm going to take another. Or I'll do something else. I'll sit on the council and help make decisions. Obviously to say, this isn't my whole life. Whereas the Sith, hey, we're going to have one apprentice, and when you've reached maximum potential, we're going to have a duel to the death. If you fail, I'll take another apprentice. If you succeed. Ultimately, the Sith Order grows a little bit weaker in that. But we think about how this translates into the biblical framework for how we train new believers. What is the practice for disciple-making that we see exhibited across Scripture? Let's start in the Old Testament. The passage that comes to mind for me, especially as I am right now trying to help my first grader memorize her Bible verses so that she can get slinkies and silly string as prizes in church from her Bible class teacher. She's like, I've got to learn the Ten Commandments so that I can get a slinky. And I'm like, well, we want to learn the Ten Commandments because that shows us something about what God desires from us. And she's like, yes, but also the slinky? Here's the thing. Deuteronomy 6, there's this beautiful passage. The Shema is what it's famously called in Jewish faith. And that is that train your children as you rise up, as you lie down, as you live life. Equip them, teach them, pass these things on to the next generation, to the generation after that. Let it be a part of your daily life. Bind these teachings on your hands and your forehead. Put them up in your houses. Let the word continually be a part of your life rather than simply a convenience. That's my translation. I'll have to check my Hebrew later and exactly if I got that right or not. Can you think of anything else in the Old Testament that might lead us ultimately to where Jesus eventually takes his model for discipleship. That's certainly to a certain extent what Jesus does with the apostles, though they're not his children.
When I think of Old Testament and maybe like the light side and like the dark side, I think of kind of the transition between Moses to Joshua.
Oh, that's a good one.
Being one that's just like really probably one of the greatest transitions that there was of power in the time of Israel. And when I look at a lot of the kings, it's like it just keeps getting worse. That's sort of like more of the dark side point of view. But one of the things I just wanted to kind of plug about the transition from Moses to Joshua was that Joshua was the aide of Moses. He watched him. He learned from him. But the text really does emphasize the point that Moses, when he's kind of, when he dies, it's like God says, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now go with boldness. And
yeah, Joshua chapter says, one.
Mm-hmm, yeah, Joshua says, my family and I will commit to you. And there's this kind of this decision that's made of, I'm not going to be waiting around looking for my master anymore, so to speak, but I'm going to take up the reins and continue this mission. And I'm sure we can get into a lot of transitions of power that were not as good.
Sure. That's a really good one. And what's cool about that is Joshua actually doesn't just sit on Moses' heels. You know, he's one of the spies who goes out into Canaan. He goes out on his own. He has one of these, you know, Luke going into the cave moments, and you might fail. And 10 out of the 12 come back and say, it's hopeless. But Joshua sees something. He realizes that God has promised us this victory. It looks hopeless, but it's not. And, of course, that's what God sees in Joshua. So he's not just Moses' lackey. He's somebody who has been tried and tested as well. That was a good example. That one wasn't in my notes, Kerry. Way to go. How about you, Kevin?
Oh,
you got one for us?
Let me add something to this conversation about Joshua before I mention two prophets later in the Old Testament. Joshua is an interesting case there because he has clearly taken to heart his personal experiences by watching Moses closely, by following Moses, and seeing what, you know, what the stories say about God's character and his might and his power to deliver the Israelites from the oppression of slavery, parting the Red Sea, all this. Like, Joshua is looking at this, and he's basically kind of drawing some conclusions to say, okay, well, based on this past evidence, and how God has worked and how God has worked to and used Moses, therefore, it stands to reason that God can do something great again on our behalf. And even though these people in this land that we were promised are, you know, they're strong and their cities are well fortified, we have, based on what we have seen God do, it is reasonable to infer that we can expect God to do other similar kinds of things.
Yeah.
And he kind of draws it. It's implicit in the text, but I think he kind of draws that lesson out and applies it to his situation very seriously. And, like, what better lesson for him to learn as a student or, you know, apprentice to someone like Moses, you know, to actually learn the very lessons that Moses has had to learn and maybe to gripe and complain less than Moses
sure
did. I mean, John, correct me if I'm wrong. You know, my expertise is more in New Testament, but I'm unaware of any time in the Old Testament where Joshua is presented in any kind of negative light. Am I missing something there?
There's nothing explicit.
I haven't read through Joshua's stories in a while.
Mike could take a little ding from whenever they attacked Ai, and they didn't follow the Lord's command.
Or the Gibeonites in chapter 8. But I think Josh was not present in that story.
Right. So, he's left out.
What is amazing is...
Generally speaking, Joshua is presented very positively.
What is amazing is that Joshua seems to have greater faith than Moses. Moses, there's a lot to be said about him. He does take action into his own hands and strikes the rock at the point in which God had commanded him to call forth from the rock. Whereas we don't see Joshua having that same failure of leadership that prevented Moses from being able to enter into the promised land. So excellent point. Absolutely. Now, were you going to take us to Elijah and Elisha? Because that one is also a good example.
I was. Yeah, I was going to take us to these two prophets named Elijah and Elisha. And for folks who are not familiar with the Old Testament office of prophet, prophets were special messengers of God. They delivered messages of hope when appropriate. They delivered messages of warning when appropriate. And when those messages of warning were not heeded, they delivered messages of judgment. And they were also, according to what we have in the Old Testament, they were also often empowered by God's Spirit to be able to perform certain miraculous deeds as a confirmation of their special calling,
right?
For this particular ministry. And the thing that I notice about that particular duo is, if you're looking for a duo of master and Padawan type, of a pattern like that, it's very similar. It's intensely relational.
Yeah.
These guys are with each other all the time. And Elijah is helping Elisha to really to view the world in basically the same way as Elijah is. He's helping him, to kind of learn how to do the things that a messenger of God in this particular fashion would do, but he's also having him really kind of training him up and helping him develop a paradigm, a worldview that says, this is how Yahweh envisions, Yahweh being God's personal name, this is how God envisions us as his commissioned representatives to treat those who are being oppressed and to treat those who are doing the oppression.
Yeah.
But it's all rooted in a personal relationship where they spend all their time together.
Yeah, I like the way you've said that, an intensely personal relationship. And when the time has come for Elijah to be taken up into heaven, famously one of the only people in the Bible who doesn't suffer a natural death, so the story goes, is that Elisha requests a greater measure of his spirit. Is that right? What's exactly the quote there?
A double portion.
A double portion. Mm-hmm. Of Elijah's spirit. And I like that as this paradigm for we are what they go beyond, right? And so thinking about Elisha wanting to take the example that Elijah had set, and most importantly, what God had done through him, right? So a double portion of his spirit. And this is a really good model for what we find happening in Jesus' way of making disciples. And, here's the premise for this whole episode. Neither the Jedi nor Sith had cornered the market on apprenticeships. There were a lot of failures along the way. Maybe on screen, the best example of one that we have is Obi-Wan and Anakin. And the real crisis there is that Obi-Wan didn't want to take on Anakin, never really felt up to the job. He was way too critical. But then they became more like brothers than master and apprentice. And of course, when Anakin finally compromised and gave in to his dark temptations, having been secretly apprenticed by Palpatine in the wings, Obi-Wan hadn't had that kind of fatherly reinforcement to keep Anakin grounded. It all went up in a mess of flames on Mustafar. The Jedi didn't corner the market on this. The Sith had massive failures, as we discussed earlier in the episode on this. I also think that we in the church have a long way to go in terms of, on the one hand, rediscovering Jesus' model for discipleship, a biblical model for discipleship from both the Old and New Testaments. And Jesus is a really great example of a better model than both the Jedi and the Sith when it comes to training an apprentice. So let's talk about how Jesus does this and does it well. Carrie, let's basically explain to our listeners, if they're, you know, a little bit unfamiliar with who the apostles are beyond the legend and lore throughout church history. How does Jesus disciple the apostles?
I'm pretty sure that if you add up the number of miracles performed by Elijah, it is 6. And if you add up the ones by Elisha, it is 12.
So, oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, kind of an interesting, he asked for it and he did receive, sort of thing. So anyways, one of the things we see in the gospel accounts is definitely this, the practice not only of an intimate relationship, like we talked about with Elijah and with Elisha, of kind of being the one who they sit at his feet and they learn, but they also, like, they eat with him. They ride on boats with him that are very small through chaotic waters with him. They are right at his feet, but he also pushes them, not just by questioning their thoughts, but by even sending them out at one point. I mean, he says, multiple points. Yeah, I've got authority that I give to you to go and to cast out demons. And so go and kind of have this little practice mission. And, I'm going to go take some time for myself. You know, it makes me think of some of the things in Star Wars, like how a lot of times, after a while, you see the master and apprentice split up, but they are still in that relationship of master and apprentice. The apprentice is going and doing something else.
Sure, that's a good example.
While the master is still doing it. So there's a mixture of leadership styles that we see from Jesus. But ultimately, I think the one that we see is one like a shepherd that spends his time with his people and is willing to sacrifice for their sake so that maybe they can become like him. And ideally, even, you know, if at all possible, which I don't think it is, but to go beyond him. And there is maybe an argument to be made for that in a sense of when he's saying that in Acts, he is, he commissions his goers. In fact, the book of Acts starts with Luke writing to his friend and brother in the faith, maybe even the younger brother in the faith, Theophilus. Another one of maybe a master-apprentice relationship there. Hmm. He writes to him and says, all of the things that Jesus is doing, in the first book, I wrote all of the things that Jesus was doing and saying, and kind of continues this idea that this second book is going to be a continuation of Jesus, his teachings and his actions. And then immediately Jesus ascends. But before he does, they say, okay, Lord, like, what are you going to do about this kingdom? When are you going to come? And Jesus's response to them is 3 times he uses you. Well, you are going to wait and power from on high will come and rest on you. And you will go into Jerusalem and to Judea and Samaria and the ends of the world. And so it's kind of this sense of, I mean, you couldn't do it without me. But at the same time, it is through you that you will do greater things than I whenever the Holy Spirit falls upon
handing
you.
Off the baton. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, Carrie's referencing, on the one hand, Jesus calls these 12 men to a 3-year ministry. Obviously, there was no time limit there when they signed up. It was just simply follow me. Most of the time when Jesus calls the disciples, there's no contract, right? It's simply these words, follow me. And they leave everything and they do so. And they came with different hopes and different expectations, certainly different motivations along the way, as we see. And as they do, they're learning from him. They're listening to him. They're questioning him. They're getting the private lessons, as Carrie mentioned, in the boat. But it's not just listening and walking and learning and hanging out as buds. As he mentions, Carrie references a passage. One of the places this happens in the Gospels is Mark chapter 6, verses 7 through 13. Jesus sent them out with two by two, right? So never one-on-one. So there's that two-person model once again, with no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals, but not put on two tunics, right? He said to them,
obviously,
whenever you enter a house, you know, we're asking for hospitality. And so Jesus does send them out, and they come back, and they say, well, not everything went right. And that's the point. Jesus teaches them some lessons there. So I hadn't thought of that, Carrie, as a mix of ministry models, a mix of discipleship models. I like that. Anything you want to add, Kevin?
Yeah, I'd mention, to stress again the importance of the time that they spent together. I'm especially sensitive to this because part of my jobs here at the church are to coordinate an effort of small groups that meet sporadically, some of which are activity-based, some of which are interest-based, some of which are more overtly like Bible studies or things along those lines. And the consistent theme that I hear from people who really enjoy these is that they really enjoy spending the time with these people. Earlier today, my wife got breakfast with with three other folks from our church and another woman that she met from at our son's birthday party, because our kids were in the same class. And she said that they stayed for about 2.5 hours. And it was, I mean, for us who had moved down here just a year ago, it was really good for her. She was growing in companionship.
Yeah.
And the kind of companionship that Jesus had with his students, with his disciples, was transformative. And if we could look back at, you know, just amongst ourselves, if we look back at our most significant friendships, I would suspect that we would say that they are transformative. I can look back at my best friend from college, who was my best man in our wedding, and a friendship that grew over the years. What that ended up being the very last year that we were there in college together was, you know, a couple times a week we would go ride our bikes around the town and talk about, you know, just kind of where we were with things. You know, I was, at the time I was dating a sister, and you know, he liked to pretend that he had a problem with that, but he really knew that I was the best one for her. And you know, ended up marrying his sister later. But
the same sister.
He only had one. Yeah. How tragically awkward would that be? Yeah. Thanks for breaking the tension there. But I mean, what ended up happening was that companionship, that relationship, that friendship was transformative in much the same way.
Yeah.
Jesus is, like Carrie, very, very well pointed out, did that in a number of ways.
Yeah. This is something that I think is sometimes lost when we examine who the apostles were, because there's so much tradition and authority wrapped up around these saints, as some faith traditions call these guys. But Jesus certainly called people to come and apprentice under him and walk with him and be with him and learn from him. And Jesus says this as much in John 15:15. He says, "No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends." Jesus is making the point that there's more to this relationship than you simply doing what I command. And in that very same passage, I would encourage people, they want to follow up on this episode, spend some time in John 13, 14, 15, 16, listening to this final discourse of Jesus as he commissions the apostles to carry on his ministry after he's gone, as he empowers them to stay connected to him, remain in him. It's not always about going and doing, but simply about being. Jesus tells them that if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. Simply being in proximity to me has exposed you to God. And I think sometimes we have different models in the church, and this is where we're going in all of this, which is either we're going to mass produce believers. You know, I did an evangelistic campaign when I was 8 years old in my town, Oklahoma, where we were trying to mass produce believers across our hometown by door knocking. We had a 15-20 minute very rote program. We would take them through with yes and no questions, and by the end of it, we're trying to get you dunked. that whether or not they would be disciples after that was going to be a different story. We can try to mass produce believers in a college, for example. If you just take these Bible classes, then you will learn everything you need to know to be a fruitful, productive member of the church. Or we can invest all of our effort in one person, as we see in the Jedi and Sith, which can come back to bite you. Jesus has a really good balance. Jesus preaches to the masses, but he invests in 12. And Jesus has other very close followers, these women who are the first witnesses to the resurrection, being some of them who are often overlooked in these kinds of conversations as well. Carrie?
And Jared, I think it's worth pointing out, too, that even Jesus had a failure with one of his 12.
Sure.
And that, you know, Judas turned to the dark side, so to speak. And that, you know, of course, in the book of Acts, it says, well, this was what Peter stands up and says, well, this is what was written about and prophesied, that this had to happen in order to fulfill the righteousness that Jesus did. But ultimately, I think if you were to ask Jesus, he would suffer and feel loss. And of course, there'd be understanding there, but Judas was not one of the 12. They had a need to replace him later.
Yeah.
And they ultimately did that.
This would be like a totally separate episode for us to dive into sometimes about betrayal. That would be a good one. How do we handle betrayal? That's really interesting. I'm fascinated by that. Did Jesus called Judas to be more than a betrayer. He called him to be a disciple. But yeah, that's a big can of worms for sure. But that's a point well taken as well. Jesus has a really effective and important discipleship model that we often overlook. But let's think about what this has looked like in the church. In the New Testament, we get a couple of examples of this. Kevin, I know that you had one.
Yeah, you're talking about Paul and Timothy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul calls Paul an apostle, and again, for folks who are maybe don't have much of a church background, apostle is just a word that means commissioned representative. It comes from a Greek word that means, well, basically commissioned representative or someone who is sent on one's behalf. The apostle Paul basically takes a young man under his wing and it kind of trains him to do the kind of work that Paul himself is doing. And later, in one of Paul's many letters that we still have, calls him his son. And yeah, that's not in a literal sense, but in kind of a spiritual and I would say emotional sense as well. Paul sees a like-mindedness, sees a kindred spirit, sees someone for whom he has been responsible. And it's especially common Jewish way of talking about someone who, if you as a person are like God, or if you as a person are like the devil, a common Jewish way of describing that would be to say that you are, you know, sons of your father, basically. That, you know, an English idiom is the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, or a chip off the old block, something along those lines. And so Paul here is essentially paying Timothy an extraordinarily high compliment. And again, it's rooted in this time that they spent together and the trust that they developed and how a lot of times they found themselves in, you know, potentially pretty dangerous situations. You mentioned Jesus and kind of what he did with his disciples. Jesus did not shelter them from all the hard things. He was with them, Mark chapter 5, when he went to across the lake there and came to this place where there was a demon-possessed man who was supernaturally strong and was clearly out of his mind because he was cutting himself with rocks, living amongst graves. I mean, this, like, you know, we're recording this on October 5th. You know, Halloween is right around the corner. All the decorations are going up in our neighborhood. And I passed by a number of graveyards in people's front yards because, you know, they're setting up their decorations. Like, this has all of that kind of spooky feel, but it's real.
Yeah.
And Jesus took his guys with him. And like you mentioned a minute ago, like, they're very well, you know, could have been women in this mix as well. They show up from time to time. I don't know how often they were with them all the time, but, you know, they were definitely around.
Yeah.
You know, Paul presumably does the same kind of thing with Timothy.
The beauty in that relationship as a young minister who's had some really important apprenticeships, people who took me under their wing and said, I see something in you. Would you come with me when I preach this youth rally out of town next weekend? Just ride with me and watch me. You can lead singing and we'll talk about ministry and what your gifts are and what you want to do. And you can learn some lessons from me. As somebody who had some really good mentors, I love the example of Paul and Timothy, because Paul converts Timothy. He had a good foundation from his grandmother and his mother. Of course, I know that because it's, you know, a really, really good Mother's Day sermon there, Lois and Eunice. Anyway, of course, Paul then continued to train Timothy, watered that seed that was planted by his mentors. But then he doesn't just leave him as an understudy. He's not just Paul's apprentice for the rest of his life. He leaves him. Yeah. Is it in Ephesus? To continue the work there that he had started. He has to follow up to Timothy and write to him and tell him, here's how you manage this particular ministry crisis. And don't let people look down on you for your youth. So forth and so on.
He gets to cut off Timothy's Padawan braid.
Now, I can imagine Elisha wearing a Padawan braid. I don't picture Timothy, you know, with that kind of ado.
What I like is, wasn't Elisha really bald? So was he bald with a Padawan braid?
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, because he was.
And so he had like the horseshoe, but then the braid.
Wow. Yeah. I forgot that, Carrie. Wow. Biblical hairstyles coming up on episode 10 of Hyperspace Theology. Which one should we sport in the church today? Well, I do wonder. I talked a little bit about how I have had some good apprenticeships, people who mentored me in ministry. I talked about the huge failure that we had in my hometown, Oklahoma, in terms of we baptized a lot of people, but we didn't make disciples, lifetime disciples. Mm-hmm. Now, what about in your personal experiences, guys? How have you seen the church do well with intentionally discipling people, and how have you seen some missteps along the way? And most importantly, like, what would be hope for the future? Carrie?
How raw and honest do you want me to be on this?
If it's too raw, I can edit it out.
Okay, well, all right. So, you know, when I was thinking about this, one of the things I thought about was very much some of the men, particularly when I had just started working for the church that I did, there were some men that really took me under their wing. And if I had any questions, they would give me advice. If they would ask me to come along with them, they'd pay for my meals. They'd say, hey, we're going to go on a visit. And it was very much this, I was apprenticing under them. And I was thinking back very fondly of that relationship. And it also got me to think about that there have been times that maybe I felt more of a, like I was going in with my master into the Jedi Council room where there were all of these men that would
judge you.
Yes. And I sat around in meetings with some church leaders that I felt like oftentimes I would feel maybe like Anakin felt in the first one. And I would be accused of things that I wasn't doing. And one of the things that I look back at very fondly, even was right when I started, there was an accusation that was made against me. And the guy that was older than me immediately came to my defense in that room. And so sometimes we kind of have this setting of within church work. I realize this is specifically within church work, that we can have some of these connections that are really meaningful directly above us, but we can hold bitterness for people that we don't have as a meaningful relationship with. This would be, you know, Anakin harboring bitter feelings towards the council because they just don't understand him. And I've never seen myself as that until I was kind of asked this question, and I realized, man, I think that I have harbored bitterness at times. Although I also need to give these men the same grace that I would want them to give.
That's right.
That is, that I'm not in a position of authority that knows their hearts as just as they were not always in a position that knew what I was doing. And so I look back favorably now from the learning experience of that.
Yeah.
And so that's more within church work. But to answer your question, and I'll try and keep this short so that Kevin can jump in. But that's my experience more so. But I have had people within my home congregation when I was just a boy that would take me in. This is men and women. That loved me, and that to this day, if I see them, I give them a hug, and they would go to my baseball games, they go to my basketball games. They were present and aware, and invested in my life. And it wasn't just about, believing what they believed or else. Mm. It was very much this, like, you're part of this. And we're on this journey together, and a part of that means we're going to meet you where you're at because we know that you don't have the ability to meet us where we are at.
Wow.
And that's really kind of the summary for me of what the master and apprentice relationship is it is not the apprentice coming to be like the master so much as the master taking time to go to where the apprentice is and walking with them side by side, which is arguably exactly what Jesus did.
Yeah, and what Anakin needed.
And what Anakin
needed. And never could quite get. That's some good stuff. And I appreciate you sharing that with vulnerability, Carrie. It's always risky to say, do I dare talk about a past experience that I had in the church? I think you really handled that with grace. Kevin, what would you want to add to this?
In one of the behind the scenes things, I think for The Mandalorian, we get an excellent insight into Dave Filoni's understanding of what Anakin needed from being a young boy to becoming to becoming Vader. And he argues that what he really needed was what Qui-Gon would have been able to offer him, which was a father relationship. Qui-Gon, according to Filoni's interpretation, which I think carries some validity, but according to Filoni, I think Qui-Gon was willing to offer Anakin a more father-son kind of relationship where...
Yeah.
He could have helped coach and train Anakin to deal with the kinds of emotional turmoil that he obviously had dealt with, or that he was obviously still dealing with as a child, taking from his mom, being very understandably very concerned for her. But instead, that was kind of ripped away from him. Instead of a father-son relationship, He had what could be offered to him, and thanks to Obi-Wan for being able to be willing to do this. But he had a brother-brother relationship, younger brother, older brother relationship, which served Anakin well.
At age 19.
What?
He took on a 9-year-old at age 19. He wasn't ready.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and you can see some of that, There are times here and there, I think, where we do get kind of insights into Obi-Wan's sort of introspective insights into Obi-Wan's mind and how he realizes that, you know, a lot of Anakin's failures were maybe his own failures, and so that's there's a t- to kind of bring this home to sort of what we were talking about, I think that there's a way, there needs to be, I could see a need for having an open and honest, you know, partnership with somebody in a church setting, you know, whether a younger minister or whether you're taking on somebody, something that is actually pretty common youth ministry perspective is, you know, if you are hoping that children will grow to basically own their own faith, right, to become mature in their faithfulness and allegiance to Jesus, then it is helpful for them to have something like five good, appropriate, meaningful, substantive relationships with adults who are not their parents. Mm. So they can begin to see kind of what it is like to become an adult. And that's not really something that Anakin was able to get from Obi-Wan, because Obi-Wan was so young and had just, you know, I mean, had just become, you know, had just recently become able to take on a Padawan.
Yeah, and everybody else either treated him with unreasonable expectations or unjust suspicions. And so he needed some healthy relationships from adults. That's right. It would be a good thing for us to model in the church. Have some relationships with people who are not just like you, not just of your demographic, not just with your particular set of interests. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. But, some of the most meaningful relationships I've ever had in the church have been from people of wildly different walks of life. I think that would be true for all three of us. What else can we conclude from this conversation? We've gone over an hour here. It's time to wrap it up. We've looked at the Old Testament. We've looked at the New. We've looked at Jesus. We've looked at the Sith, the Jedi, the modern church. As we bring this to a head, where do we go from here? One of the things I would want to say is that, you know, we see these models in Star Wars, which the fact of the matter is we talked about them as religions, the Sith and the Jedi. Well, they're two schools of thought on the Force, on how to wield the Force, how to use the Force, relationship with the Force. They're coded networks of people who are adherents to the Force, neither of which were perfect. They, each of their models, had their strengths and their weaknesses. Unfortunately, sometimes we can think that, well, the way that we're currently discipling people in the church, the way that I was taught, is the only way. We gotta get people through this 12-week program, and that will be enough. And as from there, they just need to show up to church every Sunday. Well, biblically, we see that there are some different models that are healthier, particularly if we look to Jesus. You don't want to just preach to the crowds and hope that people will get it, and no personal relationship involved. You don't want to just take one person in under your wing either. It's good to cast your net a little bit wider. I think one of the big points to see in all of this is that the Sith ensnare, they manipulate, they allure. The Jedi, on the other hand, they draft you in against your will and indoctrinate you as a baby and keep you in the system with very rigid rules. Whereas Jesus calls disciples to follow him freely. He says, follow me. He teaches the disciples, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I would want to advocate that healthy Christian discipleship is neither too manipulative nor too rigid, and that we have to look to Jesus as we do so. Guys, any other closing thoughts?
That's good. It makes me think of when Jesus says, to take up my yoke, for it is light.
Yeah.
And to partner with him, there is freedom. And so, yeah, I like what you said a lot about there are definitely two ways that the Jedi are trying to do their thing, and there's flaws in the system, and they're the Sith have their flaws. But we have an advocate for us who does not have the same flaws.
Yeah, good.
And is able to offer true freedom regardless of kind of where you are, even with your baggage, even with the other things. And he says, well, lay that down. Obviously, we're not going to lay all of it down, on the journey as we continue to pull side by side with him, maybe we'll be convinced to say, well, this sure is getting easier. Maybe I will shed some of these things that I continue to hold on to. Maybe I will try to look like this guy that's next to me. And that as we do that, there's kind of this freedom that comes about from journeying through this life and ultimately realizing that it is about other people. It's about, you know, one of the things I do love about the light side of the Force is that they are trying to become one with the Force. And this idea that there is no death. And I told my kids, is he dead? Did Obi-Wan die? And I'd say, no, he became one with the Force. And so when I look at all that, I just say, you know, it's encouraging to me to say that we are invited to be one with God as we take up the yoke and we walk side by side with his Son.
Yeah, we're called into fellowship with the Father and the Son as we receive the Spirit. Very good. Excellent. Kevin.
I really am glad that Carrie used the word invitation, or she said invited, because that's exactly what I was writing here in the notes that I was taking as I was kind of listening and thinking. What Jesus has come with is something that is not, it's not coercive. It's invitational. It's attractive. It's enticing in the best way. It's compelling in the sense of like a compelling argument, right? Like you not compel in the sense of like The Exorcist, right? The power of Christ compels you, right? Yeah, like that's not the idea. It's compelling in the sense of, man, you make a very persuasive argument that it seems as if you have presented reality in a way that maybe I've not thought about, and I am finding myself led to buy in.
Yeah.
That is different from many of the ways that we see in Star Wars. I mentioned, I think earlier, that my wife and I have been working through Star Wars Visions. We've really been enjoying it. We watched an episode last night called The Elder. We're not all the way through all of the episodes, but we watched an episode last night called The Elder, and it is two characters in there are a master and an apprentice, a Jedi master and his apprentice. And I remember turning to my wife afterwards and said, that was probably my second favorite episode, and that was the best description of what I think the best of what the Jedi had to offer. And the master, he would instruct his Padawan. He would encourage him. He would correct him. He would praise him for the things that he did well. He was concerned for his safety. He was a protector. But he also trusted his Padawan to be able to, you know, put himself in a potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah.
It was a lot of things, you know, making kind of necessary adjustments, right, for, you know, for the sake of the analogy not breaking down completely. It was in many ways similar to the kinds of things that we see Jesus doing with his crew in like a Star Wars way, as opposed to a very, you know, first century Jewish sort of way.
Yeah. That's the episode I probably remember the least, so have to do a rewatch. Gary hasn't seen them yet.
Man,
so I have to hear
watch it again. Yeah. Watch it again. And keep in like and pay attention to the to the interaction between the master and the apprentice. We're super nerdy at our house. We watch in Japanese with the English subtitles. And the episode before that one, I think the episode with T.O.B. one.
Yeah.
I literally recognize the Japanese voice actress because she voices my favorite character in anime, Goku from Dragon Ball.
Oh, that's funny.
But like I heard her Japanese voice, I was like, that's Misako Nozawa. Anyway, That's maybe how nerdy we get is, with it.
That's awesome.
Watch them in a different language this time around.
Yeah. But you know, like reading the subtitles, like it was reinforcing everything that he was saying. And it hit in such a way, it's like, man, this is like in the packed 15 minutes, this is one of the best presentations of what Jedi should be. Very succinctly.
Good. Now, people who equip without micromanaging. So that's ultimately our goal as we seek to bring others along on this journey with us and pass off our faith in a healthy way, a non-manipulative way to others as well. Well, you made a good recommendation there with the elder. Let's make some other recommendations if people would like to go deeper on this topic. I've got a couple from the Legends Expanded Universe. We talked about the Darth Bane trilogy. That would be good for understanding the Sith's rule of two.
Yes.
Maybe the best book trilogy with where the protagonist is the antagonist.
That's right.
You think, how does that work? It does. They're great.
We're
actually going to cover those coming up soon on my other Star Wars podcast, Legends Look Back. Rick Grace, who was our guest a couple of episodes ago, just came on recently as our producer, so you can catch more of both of us over there. I would also want to recommend the Jedi Apprentice and Jedi Quest books. They're young readers, like 130 pages. They take me about 2 hours a piece. There's like 30 of them. One is a series about Qui-Gon training Obi-Wan, a young Obi-Wan. And then there's another series about Obi-Wan training a young Anakin. Both of those really good case studies and everything that we've talked about tonight. And they're very digestible, very quick, but massively underrated books. Carrie, I know you just read Master and Apprentice. Would you want to recommend that one?
I would strongly recommend it. If anybody really enjoys Qui-Gon, it is an excellent dive into the mind of Qui-Gon, who I think is really probably the quintessential, Yoda, I don't think is as achievable, for people to look at, but I mean, he's kind of like the guy to look to who says, you know, he's trying really hard. His character is great. But he's also got a few things that he gets hung up on. And so I think he's really easy to identify with, for anybody. So if you like Qui-Gon and enjoy the relationship between him and Obi-Wan, it's a good book.
And Rebels would be something I would think that,
ooh,
Kevin, you might want to recommend.
Yeah.
I know you recently watched that with your kid.
Yeah.
You there have a really good example of Kanan's relationship with Ezra.
Yeah, we didn't watch it with our son. He our oldest son, he hasn't done a lot of Star Wars stuff yet. He's still kind of hanging out with Winnie the Pooh and those guys, and that's okay. Yeah,
it's Paw Patrol.
We're fine with that now. Yeah, and like, rarely Paw Patrol, just because we don't have easy access to it. But yeah, we really enjoyed the growth in the relationship. And again, you know, Ezra, gosh, the guy has to find his way because he is lured into a rival master at one point there in the series. And it ends up costing Kanan some. And so it's fascinating to see how they both grow, which, goodness, I think I said something about companionship is transformative earlier in the episode. That's a great example of that.
Absolutely. Well,
I just punched a microphone.
Before Kevin
really
knocks
excited.
The mic off the table, we'll wrap up this episode. That does it for this week. Thanks for listening to Hyperspace Theology. Gary, thanks for joining us as
Absolutely.
Our guest. It's really been good catching up with you as a friend. Thought you really brought a lot to the table. Tell folks what is going on with you in your Star Wars spare time. You got any big books you're reading, shows you're watching?
I'm gonna go and watch some Visions. I didn't even know it was out yet. I play my Star Wars game every day on my phone.
You still playing that thing?
You know what? I took like a 2-year hiatus and then some guy got me back in it and I don't even remember what it's called. Galaxy of Heroes.
Yeah.
There it is. Yeah. So I'm still in Star Wars every day, but watching my son fall in love with it, reading him some of the books, as well as walking into his room at like 8:00, 8:15, when he should have his light off, but he's trying to learn to read with Star Wars books.
Oh, that's cool.
Man, it does the heart good.
That's satisfying. Kevin, tell us about the new season of Faith in the Folds. I've been listening, and I'm really excited to get to hear perspectives on the whole New Testament.
Yeah, thank you. So on my other my personal podcast, Faith in the Folds, we are doing a new series, kind of taking a deep dive into the New Testament. We started off with a professor from our alma mater, Dr. Kevin Youngblood, who has a great balance of ministry experience and also academic publications, and so he can speak to both worlds very well. Well, I started off the series with him and basically asked the question, okay, how does the Old Testament anticipate Jesus? And because Old Testament ends with sort of a sense of incompletion. There's a sense of expectation that God is going to do something else. And so, you know, basically how do we kind of get from there to, you know, Jesus making sense out of all this?
I loved the episode so much that I preached my most recent sermon based off of some stuff that I heard in it. Yeah.
You told me that before we started recording, and I'm honored, and I think he would be as well. And then a couple of other episodes about just how do we understand the Gospels as works of history? Why are there differences in the Gospels? And then from there, I interview scholars from all over, from a variety of church backgrounds, and ask them, you know, tell us about this particular book in the New Testament. You know, what kind of literature is it? What are its aims? You know, what are some major themes? What contributions does it make? And near the end, we get personal. I ask them what's their favorite passage from that particular book. And so my hope is to march through the New Testament, either book by book or kind of section by section. I just recorded an episode yesterday with a professor from Australia on the letters of John. And so we'll kind of take some of the shorter ones and combine them. But my plan is book by book. And so far, we've got several episodes recorded, and those are going to start coming out on Fridays, 10 a.m. Central Time.
Awesome. Just downloaded one as you were saying that to take on my trip this weekend. And I can listen to the episode with the Australian scholar while I drink flat white. Do you guys serve those at the brew, Gary? That's like the Australian cappuccino, right?
I'm the only one that can make it, but you gotta know who to ask. We've got a few Australian kids that'll come in and ask for it, and I'm like, yeah, I'll make it.
Awesome. I was actually just joking. I didn't expect you to say yes. That's cool. Well, remember, just like Reed did, you can submit an episode topic for us, and we might just give you a shout-out on the show, no promises. Maybe even a t-shirt. Just kidding, we don't have t-shirts, but we could manufacture.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we don't have any merch.
Like Jedi robes. That sounds expensive. Maybe one day. Well, we'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening. God bless, and may the Force be with you. And so hit...